Hi, and welcome to Matt's Chit Chats, where I talk to all sorts of different people about all sorts of different things relating to languages. My name's Matt Absalom, and I'm an Italianist who's always ready for a good chit chat. In this episode, I'm joined by Cosimo Marco Scarcenni, who we'll just call Marco, and I think that's the name that you prefer to go by, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the background of your name?
Yeah, I'm a scholar from University of Padova. It's a university based in Italy, in the northeast part of Italy. And basically, I'm a sociologist of communication and culture. And but for more international panorama, I kind of find myself as a media scholar, because I work on digital culture, digital media, in relation with sex, sexuality, intimacy, masculinity. So all that topics connected to sex and gender and sexuality. My work focuses more on this kind of connection between digital culture and intimacy in general. And I used to work a lot with young people in terms of research, but also I'm doing lots of projects to work with them, to speak with them about these kind of topics that I think that are very, very important now in this period. And in a period that I think to be challenging in terms of speaking about these topics, mainly in Italy, where we have quite conservative, at the moment is not quite, is a conservative government, and also our culture sometimes could be defined conservative. So I think that is a super very important topic to study, to and to work with young people to construct another kind of view about what it means, sex, gender, mainly in digital culture, but not only digital culture, of course.
You talk about the impact of COVID-19 on online and offline intimacies. What do you mean by that? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, COVID-19 affect, of course, all the world. I mean that, and I think that it could be defined as a turning point for the definition of intimacy in relation to digital culture, because before COVID-19, there were lots of stigma connected to what it means to connect sex, sexuality, and gender with digital culture. And but during the pandemic, we were obliged to stay at home, so it was the only way to connect each other. And also for sex, sexuality, intimacy in general, it was an important way to keep in touch in terms of stay with other, interact also with sex, I mean, just like sexting, you feel, or have sex through chat room or Zoom or whatever. Mm. And so we have the idea that people had about mediated intimacy changed a bit. Of course, not totally, not radically. Mm. I mean, it's lots of people think about that sex, sexuality, intimacy, when passed through digital media, become more dirty, no? And, for example, if we use this kind of approach that Gay Rubin is an anthropologist that work a lot on sex and sexuality, and in the 90s, she described this kind of scheme, or she described some differences between good sex and bad sex, how society defines good and bad, because, of course, there is nothing normal. If we can we speak about from sociological point of view, everything is socially constructed. And so Gay Rubin described these differences between good sex and bad sex. And just to do an example, a sex due for have children was considered good. The sex for fun was considered bad, for example. Sex within technology, so named sex toys, for example, was considered bad, and sex just between bodies was considered good. Now we can see how it changed in the last time. And but if we think about media, every time that the medium put itself between bodies, it's like, you know, the people thinks that it makes these interactions dirty. Think about how many times we think we say that real friendship is a face-to-face friendship and not, you know, when our parents used to be, Facebook friendship is not a real friendship. Mm. And now it's the same with Instagram, with TikTok, etc. And so there is this stigma about technology. So every time that a technology become central, in between, I mean, it puts itself between bodies, it seems like it's not a good sex, it's not a good connection. Mm. And so I was speaking about with colleagues some days ago about, for example, dating apps. So in relation to your question, how we consider dating apps changed now during the COVID-19 pandemic, but now we cannot say that it's totally different. So lots of people accepted this kind of a connection. There are lots of people that found their partner thanks to dating apps. There is now a big stigma. So now people are more open to say, oh, you know what? I met my partner thanks to Tinder, Bumble, Grindr, whatever. But, for example, in the last interview we are doing, people say that they don't feel totally good to open Tinder in the tram, for example, in the train where people can see that. And so it is why, for example, people ask to move from Tinder or Grindr or whatever to another application like Instagram, WhatsApp, because they feel like more comfortable to open it in public because they feel like this stigma. So we have this kind of change, but it's not like a total revolution. So we have to pay attention when we speak about society changes and technology, because we tend to say, you know, 0-1, so something that totally changed, but it's something that is very, very connected to culture. So we can see this, for example, in Italy, and for example, I'm curious about what is happening in Australia or another country, US, Japan, etc., because it's very connected to culture. So this is what COVID-19 told us about the digital connection. But again, it's not a total revolution or something that we have to study more, because now we just exit from this period, and now I'm curious about what could happen in the future. So if we have a trend, so we are going to accept more and more this kind of technology into our intimate life, or if it's just a moment. I think that is a trend. I mean, think about pornography, think about sex by phone or a letter where lovers tend to exchange also very intimate information or desires. Mm. So it's not something new. But every time we look at the novelty of technology, something that is dangerous or inappropriate, etc. So I think that if someone asks for what about letters and having sex, I mean, from distance, and with letter, people could say, "Oh, it's romantic," because now it sounds like an old technology.
It's vintage.
Exactly, it's vintage. So everything is vintage seems to be more pure for love.
More authentic.
Authentic. Oh yes, absolutely, yes, yes.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting this way we consider. If there's something external involved, somehow that compromises the nature of the relationship. You talk a bit about the deplatforming of sex from mainstream social media platforms like Instagram. Do you think this is a response to maybe the freeing up of ideas during the pandemic? Do you think it's a reaction to that, or do you think it's some other?
I think that could be that there is a connection with pandemic, but I suppose that it's something that comes from before pandemic, because all the social media are connected to some so-called social media logics. So in the past, as media scholar, we spoke about media logics, so how media has their own logics that can affect also our behavior, not in terms of cause and effect, of course, because we cannot see something like that as a media scholar, but as something that is intertwined with our everyday life. And if we speak about social media, we have this social media logic that are more connected to what we do. So I'm just for people that maybe are not familiar with this concept. For example, if you do a photo and you publish it in Instagram, for example, we all know when to publish it. I mean, you know that if you publish it in and at 3 a.m., probably your audience will be smaller than another audience. So we know that to publish some photo in a specific moment of a day could be better. We know how to take that photo. So, for example, if we have a selfie, usually we don't use to put a phone under our face, like because our face become different and it's not good. So we'll know that. Also, if we are not communication studies scholar or students of communication courses, etc. So we know the logics about the quantification of like, etc. No, so we are interiorizing that. And so we're living in this kind of platform. I mean, I said living because we use that in everyday life. So we use it like it's not a different space compared to face-to-face space or physical space. So we are going to live in a continuum between media and everyday life. So using this kind of logic, we start to use more and more Instagram to also to share emotions with others, to share information, to share moments, different moments. So, of course, during pandemic, we had an acceleration, if we can say something like that, because we need to share moments with people that were not in our home. And also, lots of us, and mainly young people, needed to escape from house in terms of, you know, with mind. I mean, it's another typical use of media. I mean, also books was like that. No, I read the books and I start to think about something different from what happened in my house. No, but in this case, during pandemic, we were during lockdowns, and mainly probably in Australia, where very long lockdowns, etc. Yeah. People needed to keep in touch with their friends, but also to, you know, disconnect it from their home. So, lots of time when we speak about the pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic, when we spoke about that, we forgot to remember differences between people, social differences. So maybe someone could have a big house, lots of rooms, and other people just had to live in a small house, in shared spaces, and it was very difficult to, you know, to live. So sometimes people needed to escape and to connect with people outside. So, of course, COVID-19 accelerate this kind of behavior, but again, it was not the only point, the only cause that modify everything. So I think that is like this, yeah.
Absolutely. I found it interesting reading different papers that you've written. And one thing that has stood out to me is you often talk about the coexistence of contradictions. Yeah. So in one piece, you compare the recent Trump administration's attempts to narrow definitions of gender, while at the same time the presence of LGBTQI plus representation was growing on TV programs. How do you think digital media is reconfiguring these representations of gender and sexuality?
Yeah, I think that digital media are very important in this reconfiguration in terms of we all are experiencing this kind of ambivalence in the world, in media, but not only in the media. And we have a lot of administration, Trump administration, but now in Italy, for example, it's the same. Think about what is happening in Hungary where gender scholars have been banned now, or other country in Poland, where there are lots of problems with the government that are against gender studies. You know, there are lots of this kind of movement called anti-gender movement that, you know, say that there is this gender ideology. In their words, of course, it's not my words. So they affirm that gender ideology is going to work in school to modify, change young people's minds, etc. So this kind of pressure, and some government are using this kind of rhetoric not to have more consent from a part of people. So this is important, and we can see it quite easily in digital media, because digital media are totally ambivalent in terms of you can find everything in terms of one position on the contrary. You speaking about, for example, TikTok, that is, I suppose, a good example to speak about that. You can find people that replicate this rhetoric, so against gender studies, against gender ideology, what we call that, gender people that reproduce classical position in terms of gender, what means to be man and what means to be woman, without considering any other kind of identities. But on the other end, you can find lots of people that speaks about sex, sexuality, what to be, what it means to be a transgender person, for example, or what to be, it means to be a gay man, a lesbian, or you know, or simple, every kind of identity that exists in the world. In terms of the other approach, tends not to delete the complexity, tend to reduce everything to white and black, good and bad. No, instead we can find other kind of approaches in the social media or in digital culture in general. That's not the problem, I mean, but that's a good point to work on, because the access to this kind of content are different between people. So it's not just a space where you can find the plurality. Is a space where you can find also eight discourses against, for example, LGBTQI plus community, so eight speech versus space that help people to, for example, coming out, or people that discover coming out in social media to help other people say, this happened to me, it could be helpful for you, etc. So this kind of ambivalence to me is very interesting, and is what we should work on, because it helps us to understand that it's not just a matter of content or app or platforms, but it's also a matter of receptions. No, so we can work on people that produce this kind of content. This is an important topic, but we can also, I'm more interested in audience studies, for example. So for us, it's very interesting to understand how people use this kind of content, or how people can interpret, can understand, can go through this kind of content. This is strictly connected with culture and the cultural instruments that people have. Again, going back to young people, it's important not just think about, okay, this kind of representation, but also what kind of instruments they have for go through this kind of content. It's a big debate if you think also about, for example, pornography or this kind of content, again, because for someone, for some governments, for some people, it's just a matter of ban. So leave content from social media, leave content from digital environment. For other people, and I think I'm in this second group, it's a matter of create instruments from young people or people to understand what they are saying. It's not just, you know, we know as media scholar that, you know, there is not just a direct connection as I see something and I do something. It's a matter of your experience, your knowledge about that, and all these stuffs are connected to the everyday life and the possibilities that people have, so school, education, etc. I like to say to add complexity, so not just saying that something is good or bad, but really work on what people do, also to understand the subcultures, for example. So again, speaking about young people, we need to know how they consider this kind of content, which kind of subculture between peers, you know, happen in this, the use of this. So for example, I did some works on pornography again, and how young people in Italy use pornography. It was not just something connected to pleasure, but also to discover something, to understand the differences between bodies. No, so it means that we need to help them to have more, no, instruments to understand that it is a media product. No, it's not just something that happens. So they can help. It could be helpful to help them in this way. I mean, also speaking about sexting, for example, is the same.
Something Italian that particularly piqued my interest last year was the program on the national broadcaster, the Rai, called Sex. Are you familiar with that program?
Yeah.
I found it, from an Australian point of view, I found it a really interesting program. It's in 6 episodes. It's an Italian program with, you know, an Italian presenter. There's a sexologist on there. There's a psychologist on the panel. And there's a studio audience of young people. And in the 6 episodes of Sex, each one has quite a provocative title, like Sex Toys or Sex and Disability. The thing that struck me was, firstly, the title in English. And we know that using English in other language contexts, you know, there's particular reasons for that. And the description of the program was something along the lines of an entertaining but educative program. And I think this is sort of interesting and similar to what you're saying about providing tools, if you like, for people. Have you got a view on that program?
Sorry to respond in Italian because I was thinking about Italian context. I respond in Italian. Yes, I think it could be interesting to analyze, and that program shows us lots of interesting things. Like, okay, starting from the name. Okay, as you said, why using an English word for an Italian program is like, because sesso, that is the Italian translation for sex, sounds more dangerous or provocative, you know. As I think that no one could accept a program in TV, in Italian TV television called sesso, like Queen's, so sex in Italian. So, and instead, sex reduce a bit, you know, of the power of that word.
Give it maybe some novelty or something, or
exactly, yeah, some novelty, and also it sounds like, you know, less aggressive in which
maybe
way, because
more sexy,
yeah, more sexy, more sexy, and less dangerous, because people are afraid about that word. We continue to say that sex is not a taboo anymore, but it is. It is a lot. It's a big taboo, not only in Italy, I mean. But coming back to that TV program, of course, could be a good way to offer to young people tools for speaking about that. But from a center point of view, we can analyze what kind of tools that program offered. And there was a sort of typical tools connected to sex, because as you said, there are lots of professionals like medical doctor, like psychologists, etc. But for example, you can say easily that social science were not there, no, because this kind of idea of medicalization of sex and what is also a normative idea about what is good and bad about sex, what is right or worst, what is a good way to have sex, you know, like. But sometimes I think, again, as I told before, we have to add more of a complexity. Now, in a panorama where there is nothing, it's okay to have something like this. So we need a first step. I remember that we had this workshop in Italy. I organized this about digital intimacy and young adults. And there were a colleague from New Zealand that spoke about porn literacy. And so we were discussing about what porn literacy is. And I told them, okay, in Italy, we do not have sex education in the curricula. Curriculum. So to speak about porn literacy is something like, no, super distant from my experience. And so in a panorama where there's nothing, this kind of is a first step, but it could be important to have this kind of program. But from a critical point of view, because I'm a scholar, so I prefer to look at this, like saying, okay, great, but let's think about that. We can see how the idea of sex is something very, very connected to medical stuff, psychological stuff. So, again, something more connected to only to health, mental health, etc. That is good to have this kind of view. But I think that we need to speak with young people also about, from other point of view, that could be helpful for them to understand the complexity. I mean, that sex is not something that is like this or that. And if I may connect this to, but stop me, if I sure. start to speak something too different from your question. For example, I did this work on some app is connected to sex, about how we have sex.
The sex tracking apps.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes, no, exactly. I've got a whole series of questions
this. I'm not going to to do any spoiler.
Yes, whoever's listening, hold tight. We'll come back to this very intriguing topic of sex tracking apps. Let me just veer the conversation before we get to that. In one paper, you talk about being a sexademic.
Yes, yeah, sexademic, yeah.
What is a sexademic?
Yeah, sexademic is an academic work on sex. So it could sound like academics that have sex every day, but it's not like that. It's just a way to work on this topic that is fundamental. And but again, I was speaking about stigma that we raise in society. So what about that program? No, how we can redefine the position of sex and sexuality in society. But sometimes we think that in academia we are free to do whatever we want in terms of topics, etc. And I'm saying whatever we want in terms of I can work or not, or spend time wherever. It's not like that. But we frequently speak about the freedom of academics about their topic. That I think that is a central point about academic job, because it's not just a matter of what is useful or not useful in terms of a direct application. Otherwise, all the humanities, all the social science could disappear if we just look at them from this point of view. Mm. But if we look at that, I mean, social sciences, humanities, etc., from another point of view, we can easily see how this kind of approach really, literature changed the world. Think about philosophy. Think about all the studies that social scientists and humanities done. So to me, this is very important. Cultural studies teach us how small things are very important. Are important to the construction of public consciousness about what the world means. Anyway. To be a sex academic means to work on sex, but it's something that is not easy in academia, because, as I was saying, even if we think that academia is a free space, there are lots of politics, power. No, it's a system. Academia is a system. It's not something that is disconnected from this kind of behavior. And sometimes also in academia, sex create fear about what happened if someone say that in my university we speak about sex. And Linda Williams is a great scholar that used to work in US, and she was the first one that created the term porn studies. When she spoke about porn studies in their class, so speaking about sex, sexuality, etc., the first class was followed by lots of articles in the newspaper saying, "Oh, in university they speak about sex. Now where are we going?" Last year, I used to teach online, because of the COVID.
Sure.
And I remember that a student of mine tell me, "Oh, professor, my mother asks if you really were speaking about sex toys during an university lecture." But they say, you explain to her that it's not just how to use that, but is what is the role of sex toys in society and how we can consider that from an STS perspective or media perspective. So, no, it's just taking something that could be considered maybe also funny, to speak about society. Because, again, cultural study, when spoke about popular culture, explained us that it is an important point of view to study society, not just, it's not losing time, but it's something important. And so to be sex academic, it means pass through lots of difficulties in academia to have your position in academia. No, so I wrote the article that you already know about what it means to be a sexademic in Italy, but not only in Italy, because also lots of colleagues all around the world have the same problems. Because, first of all, people could look at you like, really, you are working on porn, you are working on sex toys. Really, really, university is paying for do this. No, or sometimes some people jokes like, oh, you turn your adolescent passion named porn into a work. No, so sometimes it happens like something like this. So that could be funny, but you know, it's a way to delegitimate your academic work, because it's not just like a matter of turn on a computer and go to a website, but it's something instead very connected to feminist approach, media studies approach. So you're just seeing that content in a different way. So sometimes it happens that something like this, but also it could be difficult to publish, because there are not enough journal that are on the topic. We have, fortunately, some of that are more on sexualities, for example, journal gender studies, feminist media studies. We have some of that. But compared to the places where other people could publish, no, there are not enough space. I mean, and it could be important for an academic for their career. And sometimes the problem starts from your PhD. So what it means, so you, for example, last week I had this masterclass with PhD students speaking about what it means to work on this topic and telling them pay attention to what it means, because it could be a difficult path compared to more classical or more
less taboo
topic. And so there are lots of different and challenging difficulties that I think that we as academics have to start to destroy, in terms of if we want to see at this topic in a different way. Think about I teach a course in Italy called Digital Culture, Gender and Society. And this course, old name was Digital Culture and Society, but because I teach something connected to gender and sexuality, I asked to create a new name to be more clear with students that is going to attend the course. And I asked for Digital Culture, Gender and Sexuality. But the word sexuality is not in the title at the moment, even if I'm doing lots of pressure about that, but they say, you know, arcogender is okay, but why put the name word sexuality in the title, so what people could think? So it's like to say it's not a serious field of study. Again, and we can see here again the differences between art science and humanities and social science, because it's totally normal to be a doctor that works on sex, or a biologist that works on sex, or a psychologist that works on sex, because you can define some problem with mental health, etc. But when you go in the other side of social science and humanities, sometimes it's not easy. And from what lots of colleagues said around the world, it is not just a problem in Italy. And so to be a sex academic, it means to face with some issues. And I'm not complaining. I mean, I'm happy about my work, and I think that I'm going to do that for the rest of my life. I mean, but we need to be critical about also our system, not just to complain. Again, it's not a matter of give us more space, because otherwise we start to cry. It's not this kind of approach. But it's, okay, let's think why academia is pushing out this kind of topic, why we are afraid about of topic. And we can find lots of answers, starting for Foucault. Now there are lots of people, philosophers, sociologists, that already work on that. And Foucault spoke when he said sex and craziness, is the translation, but fearfully, okay, are two topics that academia are not going to be interested in, but are very, very important, because sex is connected to politics, choices, citizenship. Now, if we can speak about Ken Plummer work about sexual citizenship, are very important point of view to observe a society. So we cannot thing that is a taboo that we cannot touch because it's an important part of everyday life. And it's not just speaking about an intercourse. Mm. It's not just like that. It's all the things that are connected to bodies, how the construction of body, the construction of interaction, the idea we have about pleasure, the relationship between people. Oh, we can speak for some... for 1,000 years about this because it's to me it's an important topic, but again difficult also because it's an interdisciplinary field. Mm. So you know, in media we have a good field: Fiona Attu, Susanna Pazzone, Kath Albury here in Melbourne, for example. A lot of scholars, Alan McKean in Sydney, a lot of scholars at work, but. If you see, it's a small groups all around the world. Mm. It is not, you know, a big group that work on that. Again, why? Because it's a tricky field.
Mm. Mm. Did you set out to work in this area? How did you come to be working in...
In this area?
Yeah.
It happened during my PhD. My supervisor is, I think, the first one in Italy that used to work on porn and society. And he had lots of problems. I when I wrote that article about to be sex dynamic, I started also from his experience, what he told me. And he has been blocked in his career for a while because Italian academia sociologists decided that it was something that was not serious. So he said, okay, now we are not going to have a different career because, you know, you have to stop as associate for a while. And he decided to write some books on classical sociology, you know, Weber, Durkheim, you know, just to clean up his face about say, I'm a serious scholar, I'm not just, you know. And when I start, I had this idea for my PhD project about young people, digital culture and sex and sexuality. A lot of people, lots of professors in my university said, it's not an important topic, it's, no one is going to, it's something that is not important. Mm. But at the moment, I think it's a central topic. So I'm glad that my supervisor said, go on, don't worry. But before to say, go on, don't worry, he said, okay, you can do whatever you want, but remember what happened to me. Mm. So it could be a challenging field. Mm. You can find people that will be not happy with your topic, etc. But fortunately, something changed in the meanwhile. The group of sociologists that work on culture and communication start to think that it was something important. No, and so I've been lucky because that kind of small community accept, because it's a matter of not to be accepted by a community, mm. because it's a community that decides if you are in or out the field. I wrote this book because it was my thesis about young people. But honestly, what was the trick to be accepted sometimes was to use the moral panic. I mean, I critique a lot the moral panic, so moral media panic that is constructed around this. But because people say, okay, you work on young people, so you're doing something to protect them. I was not constructing that kind of rhetoric. I was just speaking about what people were doing, what young people did, what are their approaches to this, because what it was my approach to the field. But this helped me to be accepted. And then now people recognize me as one scholar that work on this this topic. Mm. So it was, the first time that I asked to my supervisor, he suggested me, why not to work on the Big Brother, you know, the TV shows? I was like, no, my God, why this topic at all? No, so I started from there and then, but for a long time, I had to work also on digital literacy because the advice of my supervisor was keep two faces, a clean one and the other one, because if you work, Irvine is a sociologist that speaks about dirty work. Mm. And she said that work on sex is a dirty work. Mm. So he said, because you have not a permanent position, the best thing is have also a clean work. So work on digital literacy, how to teach to young people to use digital media, et cetera, et cetera. Show them that you have also, it's not just this dark side as someone could identify that. But now that I have more or less have a permanent position, I'm working more and more on sexuality because it's time to work on this topic. I mean, it's nothing bad or dirty.
Mm. Mm. So as a sexademic who's worked on pornography, Have you encountered any issues in the institutional context?
Yeah, but also technical problem. I mean, that usually in academia, in a university, porn website are blocked or banned. So, for example, I remember before to go in a porn website, I mean, I was looking for a research group called sex and porn, something like that. It was not possible to me because I found that in Google. And when I click that, the computer or my department say, not safe, no. So probably someone, some buzz sounds of someone is looking porn into university, it's Marco. And so I think about the technician that works in my university, said, no, Marco, can you? Wow. So, but this is also a technical problem, and I had to ask too. No, to unlock to this kind of website or use my own computer. Now it could seems like sound like a joke, something like that. But think about to be a postdoc. So now I have my own office with a colleague that is not my. But think about to be in a common room when you start with porn and people look at you like, ha-ha, you're not working, Marco. No, but I'm doing content analysis. And then, honestly, I work more on audience, so I use more to interview people. And but sometimes people speak about the same identical content. So I go to see what we're speaking about, you know, without any
nefarious.
Exactly. Just no. But it is the double side of this problem. No, people that look at you that you're not open your web page on journal website, but on porn website, and then also this. So you have to justify or to explain why you're seeing that, or you have to do that in at your home.
Just before coming in to talk to you today, I did look up that program on the Rai, the sex program, and putting in the word sex on my computer, it just opened up. There was no issue. But maybe there is a technician in the university and the thing's going...
yeah. I mean, it's interesting, also important, because, of course, in the one end, it's the problem, I mean, with this topic in general, also in social media, because in the one end, you want to protect people in terms of, you know, people that work and not lose time, or people that maybe don't want to see that kind of... I was speaking about my size, so I can open my... I want to open that website to see and study, but what if a friend of mine, colleagues of mine was not...
Comfortable. Why do you think it's so difficult for us to use language which might cause, a bit of discomfort? You know, why can't we talk about sex?
Yeah, I think that the matter of the topic on language is central. I mean, in this kind of topic, first of all, because using certain words or others are different. So lots of time we used to say intimacy because it's better than say sexuality because it's like sounds more smooth, no? Like it's
like easier. A euphemism almost.
Exactly. In sex, it's a lot of hierarchy. So intimacy is okay. Sexuality, more or less. Sex is. Now, the word that is better not to use because sex is recalled immediately to an intercourse, an interaction, a sexual interaction. I mean, but why is it important to speak about a language? And because this kind of a language creates the reality. I mean, a representation, not just of the words, but also media representation, create the idea we have about that. Another example that I use a lot with my students are a representation of Vesalio. Vesalio was a medical doctor that in 15th century represented the anatomy. He was one of the first that start to work on anatomy. And when he represent female genital parts, it was like the negative of a penis. Now, so when you say that, so is it to explain how that kind of language, the representation, could help us to understand society? Because in that kind of society was androcentric, so all around the man, so also the body, when they represent the body, they represent the body, the women, like, the negative, not the opposite, but like something that have to content the male. No, it is the same with language. So how we are free to speak about something, when how we speak about something, how we use euphemism to say a specific word, what we can put in the title of it, of a course or not, what we can show in class or not.
Mm.
Think about today is totally different, because today with the internet we have access to everything, to every practice, also the more, most extreme practice, violent in some way or not. And is why I insist into saying that we need to speak about this topic, also to create the tools to understand.
In your work with adolescents, there's two things that struck me. One was that there seemed to be very clearly defined gendered behavior. So girls did this, boys did that.
Yeah.
Do you think that's unique to the contexts that you were researching? So I guess I'm referring to Italy. And how much do you think it's derived from, and we've sort of touched on this as you've been talking, this notion of society molding the way people behave?
Yeah, I think it's connected to culture and Italian society, but I think it's not only in Italy. I mean, during adolescence, people tend to be more, how can I say, like divide black and white, good and bad, because they are in a continuous research of identity, more research experience. They experience different, differently by identity, etc. Someone called it like a crisis period, but I think it's not a crisis period. It's just a matter of meeting for the first time, lots of experience.
Mm.
So when we face with new things, we used to be more straight in terms of good, bad, this or that, because we need to find easily a way to resolve problems or to consider our identity, for example. So I think that during the lessons, it could be quite common to find this kind of behavior. So men act like this, women act like that.
Mm.
To be a man, for example, it means to show to the other that you are heterosexual and that you are not a woman. And so you have to show to perform some behavior to show to the other, to the rest of the group. And of course, it changed during the life, because at a certain point you recognize that it's not just like this, it's something different. And so some homophobic game starts to stop, for example. Some idea about women changed, not for everyone, unfortunately. No, so it depends also from which kind of experience you had in your life. So if your family have a certain view, if rest society that you meet have that kind of view, it could be difficult to change this kind of behavior. Instead, if you meet at school or with your friends or doing sports, for example, you find someone that helps you to have different point of view. Probably in Italy is more stronger because the environment. I mean, if, for example, now you listen at our politicians saying something that helps you to feel sort of a temperature of a society. So if this is what you feel like normal, you continue to reproduce this kind of stuff. But I think that is not a matter only in Italy, because I think, for example, about some studies that they did in France, where this colleague called Pascot wrote this article, Dude, you're a fag, recalling a part of an interview where people, she said that young people jokes about what means to be a fag or not, just to define their own masculinities.
Mm.
There are lots of research also in US about young people that, again, start compare their own way to be male or female, and so in this very, very normative way. So you have to do this, because otherwise, if you're in between doing adolescence, could be difficult now, because you are looking to define your identity. And so it's why we need to help young people also to, as I told before, to our complexity.
Mm.
Because it's not just a matter of to be man or woman, because what it means to be a man. Mm. I mean, what it means to be a woman, or proper man or proper woman. we have to also to help that, and because otherwise we could face with a risk that some discourses of hate, for example, I did this work on a WhatsApp group in Italy composed only by men, where we can find lots of discourses that are very close to manosphere. I don't know if people are familiar with manosphere, where with a constellation of websites, forum, etc. that are full of hate against women, hate against LGBT community, hate against feminism, etc. But this is my what I'm working on. This period, I'm writing a paper on this. Sometimes we lose to the view on everyday life of young people. So we look at these big issues that are big issues, of course, but we forget that this kind of rhetoric are quite normal into the so-called homosocial groups, so groups composed by, for example, only men. Mm. So they reframe this kind of discourse. Ah, we are joking, it's just a joke, etc. But the roots of this discourse are similar to incel discourse, for example. Mm. And what happened? It happens that lots of them, I mean young people, is going to change their mind or they say, no, it's just a joke, so I don't want to do anything like this. But it's like a sliding door. It depends on your experience. If you find someone that can help you to understand that are bad discourse in terms of, you know, we are speaking about human being, not about objects. Mm. Mm. But probably some of them continue to this path. It is it's dangerous because this, if you have a look to incel culture, for example, it's very violent and have a specific idea about what man is and what men have to have in terms of women, in this case, what women are. And coming back to the question that did before about Trump, about sub-government, if you look, that discourses are very connected to this idea about what a man is, what a man have to be. And this idea affect, of course, women, affect, of course, LGBTQ community, but affect also men's life, because it's something that affect everyone. It's not just a matter of someone against the other, but it's a matter of society.
Mm, absolutely. You were just talking about incel. Do you just want to give us a quick definition of that, just in case people aren't aware?
I take for granted the term. Sorry. Incel is for involuntary celibate, so it's people that...
Men,
yes. Oh, there are also femcel, actually, but the majority are incel, so this male, that create this group that have a specific rhetoric. It's a rhetoric that is connected to the idea that they are without a partner because society look at them like wrong, etc. And that the base of the discourse is that women has a power. Mm. Women have a power because they could choose. Instead, they are alone because women do not accept them. And they say, as a male, we deserve a woman. Mm. So is a problem of society, is a problem of feminism that is destroying the male power. No, and the idea is that male power is because there is a female power. So the power of society construct around men was to made an equilibrium between male and female. And of course, this kind of rhetoric can reach in violence, reach in hate. So it's a super quick explanation. I hope that is okay.
No, that's great. In one of your papers, you talk about the normative ideas about masturbation as an activity that should not be done frequently and desire as something that should be kept at bay. So we've just been talking about sort of normative ideas.
Yeah.
Given that that paper was with Italians, I want to ask you again, do you think that in other contexts, this sort of normativity?
I think so. Then, of course, we can have differences between different countries and connected to the influences of the culture, of the Catholic Church, of religion. Mm. But you know what? Probably we are now speaking a lot about Western world, And lots of time we forget the rest of the world, I mean, Arabic places, countries, East, etc. But so, of course, I'm not an expert of what's happening in Japan or what's is happening in China, etc. So I'm not lots of information about that. But we already know that there is a different approach to sex and sexuality. But if we speak about West country, that I know better because of lots of literature, this is not a problem. But we have this kind of Eurocentric or West-centric approach. So lots of studies comes from this region of the world. And so for example, now is a debate in academia about this. So we are looking for involve more scholars from Africa, from South America, from...
the Global South.
Exactly, exactly. The Global South is important because... But if we speak about the part of the world that we know better in this sense, I can say that is quite everywhere like this. It's easy to recognize that if we visit many cities around the world, there are a sex museum, because it's... super sexy, sketchy, people go. So there is one in Amsterdam, of course, but more or less everywhere. I don't know if in Australia there are any museum about sex, but probably if we check in Google, we will find something. You know?
That's a task for our listeners.
Go and look for...
the sex museum.
The sex is not an advertisement from sex museum in Melbourne, I don't know. But anyway, in this museum, lots of time in the rhetoric, in how people speak about sex, one of the first things was instruments, tools, to avoid young people to masturbate, for example, no, because it was something not good. The old rhetoric, you know, yeah, you become blind if you, blah, blah, blah. That seems like something from the past. But if we look at common sense, if you look at how people speak about that, we are not so distant from that kind of approach. And so there is this kind of normative way to see masturbation, of course, and also sex. So... first of all, we think that sex is just penetration, no? So penis and vagina, and that is sex. Sometimes we as society, I mean, consider sex two persons from a safe sex that have an intercourse, but society describes that kind. No, indeed, sex between female, for example, it seems like, well, what's wrong here, no? Because the typical idea is that idea of sex. But it's very normative because also for the year, in this case, if you think about journals that speak about sex, no, the rules how to do to have good sex. And Maggie John Barker, that is a great scholar that work on the representation of sex, draw this good sex, bad sex bingo. We're speaking about the representation of sex in the media and where there are this kind of idea what good sex is. For example, erection is equal to desire. So if you have erection, you are desiring something or someone, or that good sex is like that. And the people who are listening to us, if you write bad sex bingo in the internet, you can easily find this bingo. I use a lot with my students to explain them representation because we continue to have this kind of normative idea. So, for example, the length of intercourse. No, and so good sex is something that is long sex, and also the journal that speak about exercise to good eat better, or you know, without thinking about that, I cannot say that everyone is different in terms of as a superficial thing to say, but we know that pleasure is not something that is defined once forever. Also, we have different pleasure in our life and in a different period of life. Now, we have a debate about this because from more constructionist approach, where I come from, also pleasure is socially constructed. Now, so if we think about what Simon and Gagno called sexual script, for example, it's not just a matter of how to have sex, but it's also a matter of what desire is. what is exciting for me or for other people? What is exciting for a culture, for another culture? And sorry if I go back to porn, but if you we see the consumption of porn in different countries, we can see there are different typology of porn that are the favorite in that country and the other. Why? Mm. Because culture is important also to create the desire. It's not just a matter of biology. So it's not like I see that and I get excited and, I start to think about something. But it's something connected to culture, connected to the behavior that we do every day. So to go back to your question, absolutely yes, it's like this. And we have a very normative view of desire and masturbation, etc. And I think that is something that is quite everywhere. I mean, each society defines their own. Think also about what it means to look at someone in the metro, in the tram, in Italy or here, smile to someone here or in another country. The culture creates this kind of barrier about what is good, what is bad, and what is appropriately or not in, of course, in public space, in private space. So yes, there is a normative.
Absolutely. Let's get to the sex tracking apps. From my understanding, these are like fitness apps, but they collect data about sex. And in your work, you describe how they reduce sex to metrics and measures of performance with gamification, providing things like trophies. The danger with collecting this data is the creation of a new norm of good sex based potentially on these limited performative aspects, and discounting completely the recognition of intimacy.
Yeah, if we want to connect this to the idea of normalization, normative approach to sex, sexuality, sex tracking apps are a great example. And we have this kind of risk that you described, and I'm going immediately there. But we have also another risk because of this kind of app, if we think about platform society, usually we do not know where this kind of data
is going.
So, and when I say data, just to better explain to people that are listening to us, it's not just a matter of how many times you have an intercourse, but sometimes it's also data connected to sound, connected to the movement. So we know that our smartphone, small technology, but are extremely powerful. They have lots of dispositive inside that measure everything, the movement, the sound, the light. And take photo of our face. We have face recognition, for example. And I put my face on my phone, and it recognizes me. Fingertips. We have lots of things. And this kind of app, what they do is collect this kind of data, because there are some app that are just a diary where you can see, when you can write and say, okay, I have this relation, I have this intercourse with that, I have this kind of interaction with another one.
Like a record.
Exactly, like a record, like a sort of diary where you say. But there are also other applications that I studied that are, again, someone that record your not just a matter of voice, but the sound in the room or wherever you are, and more you scream, better it is. So it's
You get a trophy if you make more noise.
Exactly. Okay. So think about me testing, because I was speaking about this yesterday with a colleague yesterday. I said, when I started to study, I need to understand how it works. So I do something like starting to scream, like, okay, me alone, I mean, no, so and don't think about me in a in a party asking for, please come, it's not a joke to have more interaction, sexual interaction, but it was me like at home screaming, and just to see how the application works. And so more you scream, better it is. So you can easily see the normative idea, that if someone scream a lot, it means
it's better.
It's also heteronormative approach and very masculine approach, because of course the one that have to scream is your female partner in this case. So it's recorded. So more she scream, better it is. Another app measure the movement. So now I don't know the translation in English of the technology that measure the movement of a phone, but I tested putting on my bed and moving the bed and to understand another idea, a normative idea, more movement, better sex. Mm. Who says that? Mm. Now, depends. Someone prefers something more spoof, someone more rude. It depends on the interaction. But this give to the user a specific idea of what is. So these are the kind of data that I collect. So probably someone, yeah, I don't know where, could
is looking
me.
At this.
Exactly. Is looking at this, I could hear me screaming randomly at the phone, maybe. And so there is a member that kind of the gamification. So gamification is an approach that are used frequently in the app. So making the app more funny and, you know, like a video game, you can, it happens also with fitness, no? So you have the smartwatch or fitness app. If you reach some goals, you gain points. Also, some application gives you also money or discount, blah, blah. And that happens also with sex tracking apps. Now, and more different experience you have, more trophy you can gain. And but it could be interesting in the one end because you say, okay, so maybe it's not just have sex in one way. You are showing me that there are different ways to have sex. But again, this idea that you have to quantify. Mm. It's not just to show to people that there are different ways to make love or have sex, is that more experience are better. Mm. And another view that, you know, is like you have to collect people, you have a collect experience because it is the only way that makes you free. Mm. You know, but between the normative idea of the standard idea of sex and other practices, there are also people that don't want to explore, or they want to explore, they want just explore some experience and not other. And other apps just measure the time. If you think
start,
exactly. Now, it's a performance. Mm. So if it's 2 minutes, not enough. Mm. 20 minutes, okay. 2 hours, oh, great. Now, but what about that kind of interaction? Never spoke about that. And in my study, I asked to some people to use that apps and make a diary about the experience when I interviewed them. And as usual, I found interesting things. As usually, I mean, because usually when we use technology, we do not just follow the rules of that technology. It's true that this kind of technology give us a normative idea what sex is. Probably for someone is just to follow the rules of HEP and so be super normative. For other people, instead, is just to use this kind of app to change the rules. So, for example, this app with that measure the length of the intercourse. Some interviewees told me that they use that just to play with a partner. So, okay, I'm going to measure how long you are going to perform your the sex, but I do the best to make you finish immediately, you know. So it was like a sex game between the partners. So it's not something that they invented the app for, but, you know, as a new
so they subverted the...
exactly. And this, as I said, is quite common because it happened a lot with technology. I mean, think about SMS, but something that we now use not so much, but the SMS did not born because the communication between people, but with people that used to work on with telephone, etc., and then young people subvert using emoji, and now we have different way to communicate. So, to me, it's fascinating how we use technology in a different way from how they have been projected from people. So also this one. So it's important to see how we create this app. Define sex, how they have their own sex. So it could be, for example, interesting to understand who are they. Deborah Lupton is an Australian scholar. Did something on this kind of app, studying who created the app, discovering that there were men, white men. Now, with a specific idea, we have to pay attention to how people construct this kind of digital environment, because it have this bias. Now, it's a gender bias, of course, because if you create something, you start from your own experience and your own idea about in this case sex, but about everything, about also health, fitness, etc.
You describe that this focus on performance can transform a relationship between sexual partners to a relationship with the app, and ultimately, as it provides a reflexive game, to a relationship with oneself.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
First of all, thanks for reading my my papers.
No, I've been really enjoying them, actually.
Thanks. And yes, because we spoke about relationship and how we use the app in between relationship, but sometimes for someone, of course not for everyone, but I described the different approaches of different people. For someone, was very important to reach the goal that the app asked for. This gamification was not a matter about how I can have sex with my partner so how we can be happy together, but it was like, okay, I have to check the app now and see if I reach the goal. Now, it's like a fitness app. Like, it's like, okay, I have to do this today, 2 kilometers, and go, run. For someone, it was like this. So it was like to play the game with app, and so the partner was like an object useful to arrive, to interact with him.
Like a part of the game.
Exactly, a part of the game. But, you know, in this case, the partner become like a doll. You know, it's just, okay, you're useful to me to play the game because I need you, but otherwise, you know. And sometimes it becomes a very reflexive work because it is very connected to the shape of our society where performance are important, no? So we have to show, if you think about fitness app or apps like Strava or like if you cycle or if you run, lots of function to share with people your performance. Think about also academic work, to publish something in Instagram or in Twitter, etc. Not because I'm a narcissistic person, but you know, because you have to show to people what you do. Otherwise, it's like you did not do that. It affects lots of great parts of our life. So we used to share with other our performance to show that we are happy, that we are healthy, that we are good in working out, etc., etc. But it was, to me, interesting to see how also something that is very intimate like this could be not connected to this kind of idea to show the performance, not in the sense to share with other people your own things because it's intimate, but to show to yourself that you are good in. So in this case, that interviewee that I interviewed for my paper was like, okay, I'm great, and I can go better. It's like people that work out, you know, that are never enough happy with their workout. They have to be
bigger,
have more,
stronger.
And it's interesting because it shows us this kind of idea about sex as performance that is something that happened in society. So, during the you have to perform a good way because otherwise it's not a real man. This is a very connected to the idea of masculinity, of contemporary masculinity.
We've come full circle, starting with talking about intimacy and ending up sort of talking about, in some ways, the denial of intimacy and through this sort of mediation with technology. I think this gives us a lot to think about, and I'd like to thank Marco for this very wide-ranging discussion today. There'll be some interesting links to his work for you to follow up with in your own time during your reading pleasure. Marco, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me with great studio, and thank you for the question and this chat. It was super interesting. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining Matt's Chit Chats, part of the University of Melbourne School of Languages and Linguistics Secret Life of Language podcast. Special thanks to our guest Cosimo Marco Scaccenni. This episode was recorded and mixed at the Horde Recording Studio by Gavin Naber. Produced by me and Gavin Naber. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast platform. This episode is licensed under Creative Commons.